The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I saw a pale horse,
a beast.
We're told in the Book of Revelation.
This is not a human child.
Isn't an angel?
Satan. Armageddon is almost upon us.
Order the use of nuclear weapons.
The world is a fine place and worth fighting for.
From one end of the world to the other, I will oppose you.
They're here.
Welcome to the end of the world.
Wrestling not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities. This is PID Radio.
One of the more recent aspects of prophecy to come into mainstream consideration among scholars is a war that perhaps precedes the Gog-Magog War of Ezekiel 38 and 39, and that is a war prophesied in Psalm 83. I'm Derek Gilbert, co-host of PID Radio, PIDradio.com, and host of A View from the Bunker at VFTB.net on the internet. Our guest is a gentleman who became a Christian in 1992 and began writing shortly thereafter, a daily discipline of writing, in fact, that turned to a study of prophecy following the events of September 11th, 2001. He is a student of the predicted future of Iran, Syria, Egypt, and Israel, according to Bible prophecy, has written a number of books, including Israelistan, which brought the Psalm 83 war to the attention of prophecy scholars, and his latest book, Revelation Road, Hope Beyond the Horizon. It's our honor and pleasure to welcome Bill Salas to the Prophecy Summit at Branson. Bill?
Hey, Derek. Thanks for having me on.
It's good to meet you face-to-face.
Absolutely, yeah.
We've talked several times, and this weekend we've had the opportunity to actually sit, break bread, and discuss. Actually, I listened while you and Doug Hamp discussed, which was probably more productive than me interjecting. The events of the Middle East are always interesting, often disturbing, and we see things happening now as we record this on July 13th of 2012. Pieces kind of falling into place, perhaps. There's been some conflict between Turkey and Syria. The United States government, or at least the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, is arguing that we need to intervene in Syria's internal affairs. The Russians are countering by sending warships with attack helicopters to Syria as this happens. Meanwhile, the Muslim Brotherhood has risen to power in Egypt thanks to the support of the United States for the democratic opposition to Hosni Mubarak. What are the significant events, or in your view, what are the most significant events that you see developing over the first half of 2012?
Well, it's very interesting that the Arab Spring of 2011 has burgeoned into what it has become in 2012. We have, like you said, the Syrian revolution has gone on for almost 16 months now presently. You'd mentioned the helicopters that are being sent over by Russia to Syria, attack helicopters. Syria, the day we're recording, is moving chemicals out of storage areas, sarin gas, mustard gas, cyanide. Supposedly, they've got one of the largest weapons of chemicals, weapons arsenals and chemicals in the world. They're moving them around. They're moving them up to Homs, which is right near the border of Lebanon, northern Lebanon, which now there's a concern that those will get into Hezbollah's hands. Hezbollah has already gotten a lot of Syrian missiles, Scud-Ds, which can carry chemicals. Both Syria and Hezbollah now have Scud-D missiles, and they can shoot anywhere from northern Syria into southern Israel within a 400-mile accuracy, 400 miles within a 20-yard accuracy. So we've got chemicals moving around. The concerns are they moving those chemicals so that the rebels can't get their hands on them? Or are they using those chemicals to do ethnic cleansing of the rebels? Mm-hmm. That's the concern.
Well, Homs is one of the places where much of the fighting has taken place between the government and rebels.
Yes, it's the third largest city in Syria. And initially when the Arab Spring started, let's spend some time in Syria, that's where we're at right now here.
Okay.
When the Arab Spring started in 2011, it quickly turned into a revolution. So around March and April, Assad started moving some of his weapons up into Homs. And we believe some of those weapons got over the border into Hezbollah's hands for safekeeping. A lot of the fighting started in Homs. So let's put 2 + 2 together. The rebels knew where the weapons were and thought they could get their hands on some of them.
Hmm.
And initially there were thousands being killed up there. The latest reports, because this fighting now has spread elsewhere throughout the throughout Syria. But as we speak today, there's an estimate of about 16,000 Syrians have been killed in this revolution. Now, Hafez Assad was 16 years old when his, Bashar Assad was 16 years old when his father, Hafez Assad, did much the same thing with respects to repressing a revolution from Syrian countrymen, and that was in 1982, and he did that in the town of Hama, which is pretty close to Homs, and that's the fourth largest city in Syria. So basically, Bashar Assad is following in his father's footsteps. The problem is the stakes are so much higher now. He's got backing with Iran, he's got relationships with Hezbollah and Hamas, etc., and he's got much, much more powerful weapons. So the concern is ultimately, and I point this out in Revelation Road, that Syria and Hezbollah might attack Israel. And let me tell you how this could play out. When Bashar Assad heard that NATO might want to intervene, because Turkey wanted to enlist NATO's intervention into the Syrian revolution, much like NATO intervened in Libya. And, of course, Bashar Assad saw Muammar Gaddafi take a bullet to the head. He's seen Hosni Mubarak be thrown in prison, and he's possibly dead at this point in time as we air this, but they're not letting that cat out of the bag yet for military reasons over there. He's seen all that happen, all the deposing of the Arab leaders and things like that. So, you know, he's very concerned of his future. He does not want to be another casualty of the Arab Spring. So the concern is when he heard that Turkey may want to enlist NATO and to intervene in Syria, he said, I will send missiles into Tel Aviv. This was at the end of 2011, around November. I will send missiles in 6 hours into Tel Aviv. And he was very specific. He said, I'll get Hezbollah during the first 3 hours to also send missiles into Tel Aviv. And I'll get Iran in the second 3 hours to protect against Western intervention in the Persian Gulf. Very specific plan. Mm-hmm. Israel's response was, well, then we would have to attack Damascus, which is the capital city of Syria. So the concern now is these chemicals are being moved around, and they may ultimately be used against the rebels, which would bring international intervention militarily into the arena, into the theater over there. Then he would then lash out to Israel as a response to that. And in doing that, he draws in potentially Hezbollah, and he draws in Hamas and Iran. Mm-hmm. Now, he has to elicit a response from Israel in order to draw Hezbollah, Hamas, and Iran in. So the likelihood of him just lobbing a couple of indiscriminate missiles into Israel is minimal. The odds are, if it gets to this stage, he's gonna target Tel Aviv, and he might target it with unconventional warheads. And now you've got a serious problem, because now there are biblical prophetic ramifications to such a move. Because you have, Israel has said they would attack at Damascus. Well, Damascus is the capital city of Syria. It's the oldest continuously inhabited city in recorded history. It dates back to the time of Abraham and before. And a couple, 2-3 million people live in and around Syria proper. And it says in Isaiah 17, verse 1, that Damascus will cease to be a city. It will be a ruinous heap. It will cease to exist. And a heap of ruins is really the Hebrew words there. So there's concern by what's going on over there that it might ultimately lead to a biblical prophecy and the destruction of Damascus. That's just in Syria. And there's a lot of other prophecies regarding the destruction of Damascus in Jeremiah 49, verses 23 through 27, and elsewhere. But the concern is that Israel seems to be the responsible party for the destruction of Damascus, according to Isaiah 17, verse 9. It talks about desolation because of the children of Israel and throughout much of Syria, and especially Damascus. And, of course, this would be because Israel is acting in self-defense. Israel has already said, if there's nuclear weapons or anything entered into the Middle East arena, they won't be the first one to do that. Although they really can't absorb anybody else doing it to them.
Right.
But basically, you know, the concerns is it would probably be in self-defense. It looks like Syria initiates an attack into Israel, and they respond to it. And the real problem, Derek, and the reason it takes real vivid perspectives at this point in time is in verse 14 of Isaiah 17. It says that eventide you see him, referring to Damascus in the masculine pronoun, you see him, but in the morning he is no more. And it says this is the portion of those who plunder us and those who rob us, referring to Assyria coming against Israel. Overnight, Derek, overnight. Now you see it, now you don't, the next morning. And when that happens, depending on what events happen in and around that, economies that are already struggling, faltering, not improving, especially in Europe, America as well, you don't know what would happen. You could end up having oil wars starting to go on as the Arabs start to respond to Israel. You could have metastasized into Psalm 83, other Arab capitals, Cairo, Mecca, Medina, saying we don't want that to happen to us. We should come together and protect against that happening from us, against Israel. Iran, of course, would be drawn into the fray if Israel hasn't already struck them, which is another possibility as we sit right now. At any given morning, Israel might strike Iran's nuclear sites and potentially fill another prophecy in Jeremiah 49. I mean, we are talking about current events with all kinds of prophetic ramifications.
The fallout, pardon the pun, of an attack by Israel, self-defense against Damascus, would that necessarily trigger then the trigger war? Could that be, or how would that be the trigger for the Psalm 83 conflict that you write about in Israelistan?
Well, it's interesting. Syria is in Psalm 83. There's 10 populations listed. And under the banner of Assyria, you would have Syria and Iraq. Now, at the time Asaph wrote the psalm about 3,000 years ago, Assyria was mainly northern Syria and northern Iraq. At the time he wrote, Damascus was located in an area called Aram, A-R-A-M. So it's difficult to know exactly if Damascus itself would find itself being destroyed during Psalm 83. It could, but it could also be a precursing event. And I'm leaning in that direction because of you know, I don't want to do any newspaper exegesis here, but the current events are just definitely pointing in these kind of directions. But like I say, you know, Syria is a prominent member in the 22-member Arab League. And if their capital gets destroyed and you have refugees flooding into the northern deserts of Jordan and Iraq, you know, to escape, because the prophecy in Isaiah 17 connects with Jeremiah 49, verses 23 through 27, I believe. And in Jeremiah's prophecy, it talks about civilian casualties, multitudes of civilian casualties, and military casualties, men of war, in the streets of Damascus. So all of a sudden, the Arabs are seeing their, you know, a fellow member of the Arab League going at the hands of Israel, who they don't like. They're going to respond to that. They're not going to sit around idly, and for their own self-preservation as well. Remember, they want Jerusalem as their capital. They want another Arab state called Palestine. The Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood's new president, Mohamed Morsi, one of his campaign managers, before he was elected president, you can see it on YouTube, there was a massive rally, probably tens of thousands. It's much like when you saw in Tahrir Square during the beginning of the Arab Spring. And they are literally shouting, with Mohamed Morsi sitting there on the stage, liberate the Hamas, form a United Arab States, march from Cairo to Jerusalem, so Jerusalem would be the capital of the United Arab States. They're just one of the Arab populations over there that wants to make Jerusalem a capital of a United Arab States and or a Palestinian state. Now, it says in Psalm 83 that the nations come together, the Arab nations that share common borders with Israel, and they form crafty council. They confederate under one consent, and they say that that to cut them off as a nation, that the name Israel will be remembered no more. And we get the list of who they are in Psalm 83, verses 6 through 8, and I'll be glad to share that with the audience. But in verse 12, it tells us, let us take for ourselves the pastures of God. So we get a motive of what's driving them. It's different than the Ezekiel 38 motive, which is for plunder and great booty. It's different than the Armageddon campaign motive, which is to just flat out destroy the Jews. A genocidal attempt by the Antichrist in that event. So let us take for ourselves the pastures of God. So it looks almost as if all of the Arabs involved in Psalm 83 are interested in the land of Israel, which they would want to call Palestine. They won't call it Israel. They want to cut the name. They want to destroy the nation. That name doesn't even exist ever again. Mm-hmm. Which, first of all, meant there had to be an Israel rebirth, because this prophecy hadn't found fulfillment up until, you know, historically.
That's
or
right.
Or when the Jews were not in Israel, in the diaspora. But since they are in Israel, that nation could attempt to destroy that nation and banish that name forever. Now, remember, the Palestinians, for one, don't even have a map of Israel in their textbooks for the children there.
Mm-hmm.
So they just have a big, gross, undefined area called Palestine. So I'm rabbit trailing off, but my concern is if Syria goes out, the Arabs are going to want to protect themselves, and they're going to want to, you know, come against Israel. Their hatred of Israel will be intensified. And I could see Psalm 83 burgeoning out of that.
Now, you mentioned the 10-nation confederacy that comes against Israel in Psalm 83. Who are the nations that we're talking about here?
Yes, their ancient names, and I'll give you their modern-day equivalents as if Asaph was with us today. He talked about the tents of Edom as mm-hmm. the first population he speaks of. Tents biblically refer to military encampments or refugee conditions. The tents of Edom, in my estimation, if you follow the trail of Edom, Edomites were the descendants of Esau. We're told that in Genesis 36. And they ultimately started moving into Israel. They became called Idumeans, which mm-hmm. is the Greek word for Edomites. And so they resided quite a while in an area called Idumea. So ultimately, the Palestinians of today have ethnical representation of the Edomites. Mm-hmm. And they have refugees. So I believe Asaph was identifying for us today the Palestinian refugees by the tents of Edom. Goes on, talks about the Hagarines, the mm-hmm. Ishmaelites. Hagar was the mother of Ishmael. Hagar was an Egyptian matriarch, so I believe we've got Egypt involved. Ishmael is the father of the Arabs. We believe that would probably be mainly Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
He was also promised a great nation, or a nation, and so we think Saudi Arabia today would pretty much resemble that. You have Ammon, the Ammonites, Moab, and of course the tents of Edom. That would be Jordan today. Ammon mm-hmm. was northern Jordan, Moab was central Jordan, and Edom was southern Jordan. And of course the Edomites did go into where Hebron is today in Israel, the Idumeans I spoke about. So you have Jordan involved. You have the inhabitants of Tyre,
mm-hmm.
and you have Gebal. Now these would be in Lebanon today. And so you have Lebanon as a nation, but the inhabitants of Tyre, I believe, refer to the Hezbollah, who have pretty much inhabited Lebanon and pretty much taken it over
right.
at
yeah.
this point in time. Then you have Philistia, which would be the Hamas. That's where the Hamas are today in the Gaza area.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the Amalekites, which would be the Arabs of the Sinai. Some of us are starting to think there's a connection between the Muslim Brotherhood and the Amalekites.
Hmm.
So we have the Palestinian refugees, the Hezbollah, the Hamas, probably the Muslim Brotherhood, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan and Lebanon, Syria and northern Iraq, and that would be under the banner of Assyria. So that would be northern Syria and northern Iraq at the time that Asaph wrote. These are the populations in Arab states, terrorist populations in Arab states, that share common borders with Israel today, that are Israel's notorious enemies throughout time immemorial, but especially since they became a nation again in 1948. So what you have now is that what I call an inner circle of Arab populations that surround Israel that are going to confederate at some point to try to destroy Israel, that the name of Israel is banished forever, is remembered no more. Now, much different than the broader outer ring of countries in Ezekiel 38 and 39.
Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about that in just a little bit, and the relation between those two prophecies and the chronology of the timeline there. Just quick side note for my own benefit here. I should know this history better than I do. How does this list of nations compare with the list that came up against Israel in 1967 and 1973?
Well, 1967, your primary enemies of Israel that attacked would be Syria, Jordan and Egypt. So basically, they lost in the Six-Day War. Now, of course, they had a lot of support from the other Arab populations. They lost, and then in 1973, they wanted to get the land they lost back. So they surprise attacked on Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm.
That's called the Yom Kippur War. So your 1948 war included pretty much, you know, most of the populations of Psalm 83. In one way or another, they were involved or helping or adding you know, logistical support or weapons to the war. But it got a little more refined in 1967 and 1973 because it really was at that point dealing with the Egypt, Jordan, and Syria.
Why wouldn't the 1948 war then be a fulfillment of the Psalm 83 prophecy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a good argument. Some people say maybe it has already been fulfilled. Not every population was involved. So when we look at a Bible prophecy, it has to be fulfilled with 100% specificity, like its detail.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I don't believe it was fulfilled at that time, I think the Psalm 83 is a prophecy in process. And what I mean by that is that if we're paying attention, we're seeing that it has been developing through these wars. And it will, one day we'll wake up and we will say, it found final fulfillment, it's going on, the war is taking place, and they want to destroy Israel. I compare it to the prophecy of the restoration of the nation Israel. Israel was a prophecy in process. You know, if you were paying attention, you could see that, you know, one day the world woke up in May 14th, 1948, and whoa, there was Israel. But if you were paying attention, you could see that that was about to happen, dating back to when the Zionistic movement began in 1897 with Theodor Herzl, and then the victory over World War I when the Ottoman Empire lost control over the Middle East. The Arab states started to develop. Lord Balfour came out, and they were going to give Israel a homeland, which would include, at that time, what is modern-day Jordan and Israel. It didn't happen because of Arab agonization over it, and they convinced Britain to give them another Arab state called Jordan. And then Hitler, of course, tried to destroy the Jews so they couldn't get back into Israel. And out of that comes the United Nations, and ultimately Israel gets a homeland because of what they went through. Now, unfortunately, much of the church and the world thinks that Israel today is a moral obligation of the United Nations. They don't see the conspicuous, miraculous fingerprints of God all over the nation of Israel. But Israel was a process, and then everybody woke up one day, and here there it was, in May 14th. Same thing with Psalm 83. We're going to wake up one day, and it's going on. Now, the reason I don't think it was fulfilled yet is when you read in Psalm 83, you get past down to verses 9 and 10 primarily. And Asaph, who wrote the psalm, petitions the Lord to deal with the Confederate attempt in a specific fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And he points back to Gideon at the time of the Midianites, when the Midianites had oppressed Israel, I believe it was for about 7 years. And Gideon was empowered with his 300 warriors to go destroy the Midianites. I think he ended up killing with 300 about 120,000 Midianites.
Mm.
So what Asaph was saying is an historical, miraculous precedent of a war that we have before during the time of the Midianites with Gideon, deal with them. And what happened when the Lord empowered the IDF of that time, in Gideon's time, is that they defeated the Midianites, and the Midianites ceased to ever oppress Israel again. You will never hear about the Midianites oppressing Israel again throughout mm-hmm. history and the Bible or anywhere. But that's not all. Then he gets in and he says, deal with them as with Jabin and Sisera. Jabin was the king of the Canaanites.
Right.
Sisera was his general. At that time, they had oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. Now, I may have that mixed up. It may have been the Midianites for 20 years and the Canaanites for 7 years, but I think I've got it right. The Canaanites were probably 20 years of oppression. Now, Deborah was the prophetess of Israel at that time. And you can read about all this in Judges chapters 4 through chapters 8. This is where Asaph draws our attention. Deal with this Arab Confederacy the way it's explained in Judges 4 and 8, if I'm paraphrasing. Now, Sisera, Barak was the general of the IDF at that time, mm-hmm. and Deborah came to him and said, the Lord is going to empower you to deal with the oppression of the Canaanites at this time. So they went, and they won that war. And the Canaanites ceased to ever oppress the Israelites ever again. Okay, you won't find any more of them oppressing them. So the Arabs of Psalm 83 are oppressing Israel right now.
Mm-hmm.
They They didn't cease to ever oppress Israel again after the 1948 war. So I would contend that this is still an impending prophecy.
As you mentioned early in the program, Russia, as again we record this in mid-July of 2012, is moving a military vessel with attack helicopters to Syria. Russia's only warm water port, if I'm not mistaken, is in Syria. What implication does that have for their involvement in a wider conflict? Could that be a springboard to Ezekiel 38, perhaps? Or, what are your thoughts on that? What does the Russian bear do if they get caught in something that flares up in Syria?
Mm-hmm. Well, Russia is in prophecy. We believe they are involved in the Gog of Magog, Ezekiel 38 invasion. So we do want to watch for their behavior at this point in time. I think geopolitically, though, you know, you're talking about their port Tartus over
yes.
there.
Yes,
Tartus. And it on one side of it, it's where Syria's border meets the Mediterranean Sea. And on one side of the port, you've got Syria's sovereignty, and on the other side, Russia's got control. And so, yeah, Russia has interest in that port. It has interest in Syria as well. It has interest in Iran as well. And that's why China and Russia are not supporting sanctions on either Iran or Syria, other than lip service. They have vested interests over there. Russia is, if you watch it closely, they are starting to morph into the type of Russia that we expect will come, that forms an evil plan in Ezekiel 38, verse 10, to come and invade Israel with the coalition, a predominantly Muslim coalition. So we're watching over there as Russia is making a rebid for superpower, much like the pre-Cold War days. They are, and what they did back then, and during the Cold War, the former Soviet Union, was one of their main sources of revenue was military exports. And they are now busy exporting weapons all over the place. Mm-hmm. And they're selling Iskander missiles to Syria. They've got they've helped Russia, Iran with their nuclear program. And they've got weapons export contracts with all kinds of different countries. So they have a vested interest in the reemergence of their country into superpower status. They are now the number one producer of oil in the world. They surpass Saudi Arabia. They supply a lot of natural gas to Europe and elsewhere. Russia needs to be watched right now. They are burgeoning into a world power again. So they are going to have a voice that needs to be reckoned with, and they know that. And they think that what's going on with America and the West, with the bad economies and things like that, is a sign of weakness. So they're seeing, they're getting bloodthirsty, in my estimation, at this point in time. Now, so you've almost got a Cold War scenario developing again in and around the Middle East, because whereas Russia and China are concerned about Iran and Syria, you also have the West with America and the European countries that are concerned about Iran's nuclear program. They want them to stop enriching uranium. And they're very concerned that Israel is going to strike them. And what does that mean for all of their interests over there as well? So it's a much bigger deal these days. The next war in the Middle East, by the admission of Hassan Nasrallah and many other people over there, is it won't be another skirmish. It will be a regional conflict. And my concern is it's going to be of epic biblical proportions.
The nations mentioned in Psalm 83 are the immediate neighbors of Israel. The nations of Ezekiel 38, what's the geography there? Which nations are mentioned? And how does that affect the timeline of which of these two events takes place first?
Okay, yeah. Well, let me first tell you about the populations Ezekiel talks about, and then let me also tell you about the populations he omits, and then let me tell you about the Israel that Ezekiel describes that has to be in existence when Russia invades.
Okay.
Okay. The populations he lists, like, would be Meshech and Tubal and Togarmah and Magog and Persia and Ethiopia and Libya and Gomer. And there may be, there's nine altogether. I may have missed one. And the general consensus of the scholars is that they are the following countries: Russia, Turkey, Libya, Iran. You have also the Sudan, Tunisia. the southern steppes of Russia, the breakaway, some of the breakaway republics of the Soviet Union.
That being Gomer?
It could be. Some people even say Gomer could be Germany.
Oh, okay,
I don't think so. So you have some of the stands around there, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Grandstand, Bandstand, Take a Stand, you know, any kind of stand family.
Laurel Stand?
Yeah. And then so you have, and then also it could come down into Somalia, because Kush is represented, and that at the time he was more than just Libya and stuff. It would kind of go down on through there. Put and Kush were the mentions. So Kush would be Ethiopia, Put would be Libya, but Ethiopia would also maybe extend down to Somalia and Sudan. Sudan is a very radical in turmoil right now as well.
Yes, yeah.
So those are the populations he includes. They are, I call, an outer ring of countries, not an inner circle like Psalm 83. They don't share common borders with Israel. They have to cross through the borders of the Psalm 83 countries to enter into Israel, to attack Israel. And it says that it comes from, the invasion comes primarily from the uttermost parts of the north.
Right.
That's why a lot of people put Russia in the mix for other various reasons. He omits every one of the Psalm 83 nations. He talks about the Psalm 83 nations, Ezekiel does, about 89 times in Edomites, Ammonites, etc. But he doesn't list them at all in Ezekiel 38 and the population. So I think he doesn't because they're not involved. So he's very specific about who he does include, and he's very specific about who he doesn't include. There's another interesting population he doesn't include, and that's called Elam, E-L-A-M. Elam is not in Psalm 83, and they're not in Ezekiel 38, but they're an end-times Bible prophecy. It appears according to Jeremiah 49, verses 34 through 39.
Mm-hmm.
And modern-day Iran today is comprised of Elam and ancient Persia. Elam is where the Bashar nuclear plant is, and it is sort of that area around the it's sort of the western central area of Iran, right around the Persian Gulf. And so that's interesting, because Jeremiah says that that area is going to get attacked, and it's going to, the bow is going to be broken, and it struck at the foremost of its might, which may very well be, and I put in Revelation Road the possibility, and I give a commentary on it, that it's dealing with Israel striking Iran, possibly. So that's another interesting prophecy. But the thing that's important to note about Ezekiel 38, because many people think Ezekiel 38 and 39 is an imminent prophecy.
Right.
It could happen at any time. But there, I don't think it's imminent, and I'll tell you why. Because in Ezekiel 38, verses 8 through 13, it talks about an Israel that is brought back from the nations in the latter days into the midst of the land. Now, we'll stop there for a minute. That's going on. It is the latter days, and Israel's being regathered from the nations into the land. But are they dwelling in the midst of the land? The Hebrew word is tabur. And what land was Ezekiel talking about? What center part of the promised land was he talking about? He wasn't familiar with the UN Resolution 181, that little teeny partition plan. He was familiar with all the promised land of Genesis 15:18, from the river Egypt, the Nile, to the river Euphrates, which courses through Iraq and Syria today. So I think he might have been talking about an Israel that is a little dwelling a little more into the Jordan area as well. And I do believe that after Psalm 83, Israel will take Jordan sovereign. And I think you can pick that up in Jeremiah 49, verses 1 through 6. I actually think that where they bury the hordes of Gog in the valley of Ham and Gog is in Jordan and central Jordan area, east of the Dead Sea. Because it says they're buried in a valley east of some sea. And that's the most logical place for them to bury them. Now, they're dwelling secure. Now, they come back into Israel in the latter days, dwell in the midst of the land. They dwell securely, without walls, bars, nor gates, and they're very prosperous. They've got a lot of plunder and booty, because that's what Russia forms this coalition for. They come for great plunder and booty. Now, Israel today is not dwelling securely.
We talked
about that for the first half hour. They have existential threats all around them. They're not dwelling without walls, bars, nor gates. They have a 403-mile wall that courses through around the West Bank area and keeps Palestinian terrorism out of Israel proper, and it works. They are not dwelling without bars or gates. They've got security checkpoints throughout Israel. So I think in part Israel is of Ezekiel 38, verses 8 through 13, exists today. but I don't think the other part that they do, and I think they will after Psalm 83. They will be able to dwell securely. They will be able to tear down that partition wall. They will be able to grab more land. They'll be greater. They'll be safer. They will be able to exploit Arab resources as well, because the Hebrew word in Ezekiel 38, verse 13, is for spoil and plunder is sakar. And it really means, from the root word, that spoil of the spoil or the despoil. So it looks like Russia's coming after booty that Israel has acquired. And we find out that that in Obadiah, Obadiah 1, verses 19 and 20, that there will actually appear to be prisoners of war from the Psalm 83 war. We're told that apparently there'll be POW accounts, it looks like, in Zarephath, which is southern Lebanon, maybe even down in the Sinai area. There's a lot of description given through other prophets that must fit with Psalm 83 because it really doesn't fit anywhere else, dealing with these kind of populations.
So essentially we'd see a war between Israel and its near neighbors, resulting in an Israeli victory, the destruction of these near neighbors, Syria, Jordan, Egypt perhaps, Israel thinking that it's at peace, safe, secure, and taking advantage of the resources or the plunder of these conquered nations, which then draws in some of these farther nations, perhaps the Russians, perhaps the Turks, Iraqis, Libyans, the collar nations then. And so that would be the timeline that we would see for the conflict,
right,
as
so
you see it.
It's a subsequent event, Ezekiel 38. Remember that after Israel just really has a great victory over the Arabs, and the Israeli Defense Forces today exist in Bible prophecy. Ezekiel 37:10 talks about an exceedingly great army. Ezekiel 25:14 says, I will execute my vengeance on Edom by the hand of my people Israel, by the IDF, and Edomites shall know my vengeance. Edom, of course, is in Psalm 83. And there's other passages, Obadiah 1:18, the house of Jacob will be a fire, the house of Joseph will be a flame, read that as the IDF, but the house of Esau, read that as the Edomites, will be stubble, and no survivor shall remain in the house of Esau. So we have the IDF that will do this. Now, it's going to be the mother of all Mideast wars up to date at that point. Now, when the other Muslim countries of Iran and Turkey and Libya see this happen, and those aren't necessarily Arabs. Libya has got some Arabs, and it's Arabs, but Iran is Persian. You know,
right.
So it's Psalm 83 is an Arab confederacy, but Ezekiel 38 is predominantly a Muslim confederacy, not necessarily an Arab confederacy. Now, Russia's not all Muslim, but all the populations they grab are Muslim.
Yeah, some of the former republics that were part of the USSR, very definitely Muslim.
Many of those. So what you have is you're going to have a very upset community with what's just happened to Islam and what's happening with Israel grabbing land and with Israel taking prisoners of war and exploiting Arab resources. And so it would be really quite easy for Russia to come in fairly quickly and say, you know, are you going to let them get away with that? You know, are you going to let them take that land? You know, we should take control of whatever OPEC oil they're taking control of. Iran's number two in OPEC right now. Why should Israel get Saudi Arabian oil or other resources? They could easily grab the Islamic fervor and say, let's go get them. Now, I happen to throw the rapture probably in the mix in here somewhere. And let's just play that one out. So Israel has defeated a war against its Arab enemies. Jesus comes and gets the church and takes us up into the clouds to be with him forever in fulfillment of 1 Thessalonians 4:15-18 and 1 Corinthians 15:51-52. We're raptured, caught up in the air in the twinkling of an eye. All of a sudden, Western armies, America especially, they're compromised. You've got colonels and captains and soldiers, and you know, and there's plenty of Christians, you know, and the European armies as well. So now you've got different military capabilities with Western armies, but you don't have any problem with the Muslim armies because no Muslims are going to get raptured. So Russia could come along and simply say, "Look, all you know." The Western armies are in compromise or fragmented. You know, whatever just happened, you know, they've lost a lot of people. America's in disarray. Social services are shutting down because, you know, people aren't showing up to work. They're busy getting their mansions in heaven in John 14. And so they say, look, we're still intact and they're not. And the only thing standing between us controlling all the resources of the world, natural gas and oil and everything, is that little Jewish state. Let's go get them. No one's defending them. Let's go get them.
Yeah.
And I could see that happening. And then what happens is it's not the Israeli Defense Forces that defeat that coalition, which is much, much more formidable than the Psalm 83 war, but it's God himself. We're told in Ezekiel 38, verses around 14 on through Ezekiel 39, 6, that there'll be an earthquake, that there'll be each man's sword will be coming against each other. There'll be hail, fire, and brimstone. I mean, it's an Old Testament fire and brimstone defeat, clearly by the hand of God. And so Israel will behold their Lord defend them against that. And he says in Ezekiel 39, verse 7, I will uphold my holy name in the midst of my people Israel, after that he has just defeated the enemies, and the nation shall know I'm the Lord. So, you know, he calls them my people Israel there. I uphold my holy name in the midst of my people Israel. He calls them my people Israel three times in Ezekiel 38 and 39. And so where's the church? Everything gets very Jewish at this point in time, right? He's got the Jews back in the land. The Jews exist. Hitler didn't commit genocide. So if he's going to uphold his holy name in the midst of his people Israel, there has to be Jews, his people. Hitler tried to stop that, but he didn't. It didn't work out. Now there's Jews, and they're in Israel. I'm going to uphold my holy name in the midst of my people, Jews in Israel, in Israel. So you got to have Jews in Israel in the latter days, we're told in this prophecy. And so God stops Russia's attempt, and he can then say, he can banner the fact to the nations of the world that I am the promise-keeping, covenant-keeping God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I promised that there would be Jews forever, descendants of Abraham forever, and that they would have a promised land forever. And everybody keeps trying to kill the Jews and take it away. But that will not stand. It did not stand. And now the nations better get a clue that that's what just happened, because they're going to be facing a choice, because I believe this is a pre-trib event. And if we have time, I'll explain why. Because they're going to have a choice very soon afterwards between the promise-keeping God and the Antichrist, who's going to come forward with his system and cashless society and all that.
We'd only have time to like basically scratch the surface of the topic. We could talk hours and hours on the topic here, but I do want to talk transition a little bit from the subject covered by your first book, Israelistan, to your most recent book, Revelation Road, Hope Beyond the Horizon, which is a work of fiction, but not entirely fiction.
Right.
What is the book about, and why did you choose to introduce these concepts, these prophecies to readers using fiction as a vehicle?
How much time do we have?
We could go another 20 minutes.
Oh, we can? Okay. Well, then I'll give you the long version.
Any objections from the crowd here? No. Okay.
Okay. Well, I'll start out by telling you it is a unique, one-of-a-kind reading experience. It combines both a novel with an extensive nonfiction biblical commentary. And I wanted to paint the end-time story into a picture, into a narrative. And it starts in the novel, which is 120 pages. It's a fairly easy read. I sat down and read it one night. It took me a lot longer to write, but I read it in one
night. Yeah, I know.
and my backers hired a professional novelist, because I'm not really a novelist per se, although I've become one. I wasn't. And so they hired a professional novelist, Ellen Traylor, who had written 19 prophetic novels, been published with Thomas Nelson and Harvest House. So we really put together a really good, touching story. And it's about a grandparents who are concerned their grandson has been birthed into the final generation. And they want to prepare him for the apocalyptic events that they feel are about to happen. Middle East wars, like we've been talking about, future terror in America, and introduce him to the hope of Jesus and the rapture. So that's the storyline. It's really quite intricate, and I try to in the story picture it, events that could happen where their story could become the reader's story, and it very well could be if events start to happen in the Middle East. And so that's a pretty touching story. And in the last chapter, chapter 18, I advise people that read it to have a box of Kleenex with them, because 9 out of 10 don't make it all the way through without shedding a tear, and that was my case as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the next 312 pages are extensive biblical commentary that talk about the prophecies that I've written about inside of the novel. So it adds veracity to the text. So, you know, it's very believable. And the reason I wrote it this way, Derek, was because, and I don't think anyone's ever really tried this. Now, Jonathan Cahn has done something kind of similar with this book that just came out, really good book called The Harbinger.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't do a nonfiction commentary section. He does a narrative, but it's got a lot of biblical support.
There is one other I know of by a fellow named Brian Gadawa called Noah Primeval, which is about as it was in the days of Noah, where he wrote fiction about the story leading up to the flood, and then follows it with an extensive commentary based on the work, much of it from Dr. Michael Heiser, about the Divine Council. But that's the only other book I'm aware of that takes this kind of approach.
I wasn't even aware of that.
Yeah.
So he probably had the same idea. And my idea was to reach the broadest possible audience with this prophetic information that I feel is very timely, that could really come upon our generation, and if not ours, our children's or grandchildren's.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly think the Middle East stuff is going to happen very soon. But the goal was to write the prophecies and chronologically order them between now and the second coming of Christ, going through the whole thing about the Middle East wars and the Antichrist and the harlot world religion and the cashless society and the Ten Kings and all the types of things, the rebuilding of the temple, prophecies that are about to come, and try to sequence them so we can put them into some sort of a logistical order, chronological order, and make sense out of it for the purpose of preparing people for the days in which they live, because Bible prophecy is not just for the scholars and the prophecy buffs and the eschatologists, but it's for every man, woman, and child. The Lord loves people, and he wants them to know what's headed their way. And he doesn't issue prophecy to impress us, but to inform us. He's not someone with a lot of time on his hands. He holds all time in his hands. And he loves us, and he wants to know what's coming. And our natural response should be to worship him for caring. So my inside of the book, I put the gospel in it in various places, so it becomes a witnessing tool. And I try to do it in a way, unlike my first book, which was a fairly technical reading, Israelistein, where it could be read by a Christian or a Muslim or a Jew or just an agnostic. So they would say, well, it's kind of an interesting novel. You know, I'll read through it. And then if they want to get a little more of the meat, they'll go into the commentary. And maybe through that, the Lord could reach them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the goal.
How easy would it be to take the commentary at the back of the book and use that for a Bible study or Sunday school class?
I think it would be fairly easy. Yeah, because I've tried to write it in a way that was fairly articulate and not just, you know, for the scholar, but for the person, that the ordinary person that's reading it, that if they did dare to go into the commentary, they wouldn't feel threatened by that, that they could just comfortably read through it. For instance, I talk about Isaiah 17. I do an exhaustive commentary. It's a biblical study on Isaiah 17, verse by verse. And it's one of the more exhaustive ones out there right now, dealing with a look at it under a current lens with the type of things we talked about. So it's that could easily be taught. And I've posted that on my website as well for that purpose. And I've done that with Jeremiah, those passages about Elam and other passages as well. I've written a whole commentary on Ezekiel 35, the war before Ezekiel 38, because I see that connection there with Psalm 83. So it really, in many ways, is perfect for Bible studies.
Hmm. Now getting back to some of the meat and potatoes of what the book covers, the prophetic events as we look ahead. You mentioned some various aspects of the world to come. Following Psalm 83, Ezekiel 38, what do you see happening at that point?
Well, I don't think there'll be a lot of time between the two wars, because I think Russia is going to wander. Israel's going to have to dwell securely, probably tear down that wall, take a little territory and get, you know, some prosperity, some booty and plunder. So it may take a year. It may take 2 years. I don't think it'll take a long time. And Russia, as as they keep pointing to their friends, Iran and Turkey, and saying, look what Israel's doing, look what Israel's doing. Don't let that happen. Are you going to stand for that?
Mm-hmm.
At some point, they're going to put them together in a coalition. And we know how coalitions are formed these days. You know, we've seen that with George Bush, with Desert Storm, etc. And so Gog forms an evil plan. And I do want to get to your question, what happens afterwards. But I want to throw in something important. Gog's evil plan appears to be a threefold strategy. Ultimately, they come and invade Israel, and they want to take the plunder, the great booty. But they form a block of Muslim countries, so they feed on the Muslim frenzy. But if you look on a map where all these countries involved in Ezekiel 38 are located, they all border the waterways, the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, and the Mediterranean, that Israel will find necessary to export commerce, to export that great plunder and booty into market.
Mm-hmm.
And we know Israel will be wanting to do that because we have, in Ezekiel 38, verse 13, we have these protesters, these seeming protesters, Sheba, which would be Yemen, Dedan, which would be Saudi Arabia, and the merchants of Tarshish and their young lions. The merchants of Tarshish, there's a theme here of merchants. Someone wants to have merchant, you know, a merchant relationship with Israel, a commercial relationship with Israel. So what Russia appears to do with this Muslim coalition is strategically get countries that would be prohibitive for Israel to get their exports out into the world markets. And then once they've done that and boycotted that, mm-hmm. then they come in and try to take it over. Now, so what happens after that? Well, they start to bury the dead for 7 months in a valley called Hamon Gog, which I believe is in Jordan. And then they start converting the weapons into energy. They burn the weapons for 7 years, okay? And they gain renown for that, we're told. The world is going, whoa, you know, look at that little Israel that was, you know, almost wiped off the map. And they are a different, whole different country at this point in time. And so I believe it's a pre-trib event because they'll be burning weapons for 7 years. Now, if you understand the tribulation, which is a seven-year period, the first 3.5 years, Israel feels its dwelling in a sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
It's a false sense of peace. And then the Antichrist goes into their temple, which will be rebuilt at that time at the midpoint of the 70th week of Daniel, the tribulation. And he does the abomination of desolation spoken right. by Daniel the prophet. And then the Jews are told by Christ in Matthew 24, verse 15 through 18, to get out of there when they see that happen and to flee to the mountains, which we suspect would be Petra in southern Jordan. So they're not going to be converting fuel in the second half of the tribulation. They're going to be fleeing for their lives because the Antichrist is going to try to commit genocide. And we're told in Zechariah 13:8 that 2/3 of the Jews are cut off in the land. So it's a big deal, worse than the Holocaust. So the first 3.5 years of the tribulation, they could be converting fuel, burning the weapons and converting it into fuel. But it's doubtful the second 3.5 years they're going to be doing that. So that's why people like Dr. Reagan, Dr. Ron Rhodes, myself, Dr. Ronald Fruchtenbaum, we believe that the Ezekiel 38 has to conclude, not commence, 3.5 years before the tribulation even starts. So they could burn weapons for 3.5 years. Tribulation starts, they still could burn weapons for 3.5 years. You got 7 years. I mean, they could have 8, 9, 10 years worth of weapons that we don't know about, but it's, mm-hmm. they're only burning them for 7 years. Maybe there's a cutoff point there. So that 3.5 years after Ezekiel 38, what goes on in there? Well, if the raptures happen, you've got a one-world religion coming in the vacuum of that instantly.
Mm-hmm.
A counterfeit gospel, a lie of 2 Thessalonians 2. You know, it's a different world at that point in time. You know, and I think that humanity is going to be overtaken by this stuff very soon.
We just have a few minutes left. So rather than get into another question that really can't be developed fully, let me just ask this. As again, we're recording this on July 13th of 2012, and at the beginning of the interview, we discussed some of the things that are taking place here in recent days. What do you see as the next event taking place in the Middle East?
Israel striking Iran's nuclear sites. I think they're going to do it before the presidential elections of America, before November 6th. Some of us think it could be in September of 2012. And it may be that that is preceded by Iran calling on its proxies, Syria, Hezbollah, and Hamas, to actually attack Israel preemptively first so that Iran can have better protection over its nuclear facilities.
Hmm.
Iran is rapidly approaching what is called an immunity zone. and Israel is watching it very closely. And what that means is that if Israel takes the risk of striking Iran's nuclear sites, they want it to be effective.
Sure.
And presently, Iran has got that they're enriching uranium in different facilities. They've got a lot of them buried deep underground. And at some point, an attack on Iran's nuclear sites is really not going to, it's going to be counterproductive. It's not going to be productive at all. And it's liable to bring back all kinds of wrath upon Israel. So they want to make sure it's effective. And their defense minister, Ehud Barak, has said, we are watching that immunity zone. You know, they're not going to wait for it. So more than watching who's going to win the American elections, more than watching what's happening in the Syrian revolution, they're watching this immunity zone. And Iran, I mean, they're going to have to attack them pretty soon. Hmm. Credible American intelligence has come out recently, as we're recording here in July, and they estimated about 4 months until Iran could be nuclear capable. That's 2012. Ehud Barak, the defense minister, said 2012 is the year they deal with Iran's nuclear program. So 2012 won't be the end of the world, according to the long count Mayan calendar on December 21st, but it could be a lot of sparks flying in the Middle East.
Yep. Bill, you blog and write about this on a pretty regular basis. Where should people go to get your analysis of what's going on?
My website is prophecydepot.com. That's Prophecy Depot, like Home Depot, DEPOT.com. And I've got my radio show. I'm a host of Prophecy Update Radio.
Right.
I interview the end-time Bible scholars. Products are there. All my articles I write constantly. All the radio shows and TV shows I do are on there. And it's a very active site. We have news headlines on there. So prophecydepot.com.
Prophecydepot.com. Bill,
thanks,
educational.
Derek.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Bill Salas is the author of Israelistine and his latest book, Revelation Road. I'm Derek Gilbert from the Prophecy Summit in Branson 2012 for PID Radio.
Thanks for listening. PID Radio is a production of the PID Radio Network, a division of Gilbert House. Please visit our website at PIDradio.com, where you'll find show notes and links to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook. We wish to thank all those who help undergird and underwrite our ministry through prayers, feedback, and donations. To contact us directly, email us at radio@peeringintodarkness.com. Opening music adapted from The Alchemist's Tower by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. Closing music, New Day Coming by Steve Grace, stevegrace.com. Content copyright Gilbert House and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derives 3.0 Unported License. For more information, see creativecommons.org.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out of here. And living in the past, God can do a new thing now, in a kingdom that will last. He'll make a way across your wilderness, like a river flows in desert land. There's a new day coming, a new day. There's a new